The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening I would like to talk about equanimity. It's a theme that I've been teaching about some the last couple of weeks, and it's on my mind. And it's a very beautiful quality to have, internal quality, quality of heart, quality of mind, that is considered to be the pinnacle of, or the, of Buddhist kind of emotional, spiritual life. And it is sometimes seen as the penultimate stage of practice before experiencing awakening. Equanimity is a great lubricant, a great supporter for life, helps our life in dramatic ways. It's kind of the crown jewel of Buddhist practice. And equanimity comes from practice, with practices. We practice mindfulness, practice meditation, practice concentration practice. In a variety of ways, equanimity becomes a strong factor. And it was a big surprise for me as my practice deepened to discover this equanimity that Buddhists talk about and discover what a powerful emotional state it can be. And as a powerful state, how deeply satisfying it is. It's very closely akin to a profound state of peace. And if you have the most beautiful states of peace that you've experienced, that equanimity, strong equanimity, is very closely connected to it. So that's satisfying. Many people don't know what equanimity is, or if they think they know what it is, people often will have a reaction to it that maybe it's not such a useful thing, because maybe it's a form of religiously sanctified indifference, and so it's not really so, you know, or it's a kind of not caring, or it's aloofness, or you know. If we're equanimous, then we lose part of ourselves, you know, our emotional exuberance, our strong emotional life, or our feelings, or all kinds of things. Maybe they can't be there when you're equanimous, right? So people say, I don't know if I want that equanimity stuff. And but it's a beautiful state, and it's well worth becoming familiar with and exploring. It's both a state and a practice. So the idea of practicing mindfulness together with equanimity is a very important part of mindfulness practice. How can I be present for whatever's happening in a way that's equanimous? So equanimity, what is it? It's sometimes understood to be a state of non-reactivity. So the automatic habits of being reactive for and against things doesn't operate when we're equanimous. We might have ideas that this is not appropriate, this is a, but we're not kind of, there's not a reactive feeling, a lashing out or a tightening up or resistance. I like to think of it that our presence, whatever that is, our presence, our awareness, our attention, our mind, our heart, doesn't contract or doesn't tighten up in relationship to whatever's happening when we're equanimous. We might have the evaluation, this is not useful, or this is a good thing to develop and cultivate. But whatever that evaluation is, there's no waves in the mind. The mind is not agitated because of it. It doesn't get restless because of it. It doesn't get dampened down because of it, but rather stays open, clear, and in a very beautiful way. Equanimity is as a quality, is not just a quality of mind. It's something that involves, when it's strong, all our faculties. Seemingly. So it's, you know, certainly involves, there's a mental side of it. I like to think of it, there's a heart side of it, where it feels like a very deep kind of emotional state. It also involves our body and a variety of different aspects of our body that support that kind of, to support equanimity. I think of it as something, a quality that comes out of all our different, when all the different functionings of our being function harmoniously well, strong, to support us, so that the forces of reactivity, the impulses to be reactive, fear, self-centeredness, egotism, anger, hostility, desire, greed, don't kind of get the upper hand. Those forces, impulses, reactive impulses, don't shape or don't color our presence, our way of being here, our way of being with things, our way of being attentive. We're not pushed around by things. They say that when you're equanimous, you're not pushed around by the four worldly winds. In Buddhism, the worldly winds, the winds of the world that push people around, are success and failure, praise and blame, and then slightly different from that is ill repute and repute, good repute, and pain and pleasure. That these things, you know, people get caught up in this, success and failure. You know, I have a 12-year-old son who is now beating me at ping pong. And yesterday he beat me after an intense match. And he went to his room and he closed his door. And I could hear him crying in there. Because even though he beat me, there was so many times where he felt like he didn't play up to his best ability. And he felt so bad. It was really intense for him. He's a very competitive person. And so it was kind of something, you know, to play this wonderful game with him and then have him kind of go. And later on I asked him, you know, when he was calmed down and happy, and I asked him, you know, well, that was something. And is anything that, anything I can do that'd be helpful in those kinds of circumstances, but happens again, you know, what can we do? You know, should I lose? And he said his request was, don't talk about it. Don't focus on it. Anyway, so success and failure, you know, can be pretty intense sometimes if you're a 12-year-old. Now, I'm sure for you all, they've way outgrown that, so... And then praise and blame. There's been pointed out that there's a phenomenon that when people praise us and when they criticize us, we can get energized. It's exciting, you know, like we're geared up, we got to do something. It's praise, and it's like, wow, this is great. I could do more of this. And then if you get criticized or blamed for something, that's also energizing. We want to defend ourselves or do something. But when something that neither pumps us up or depresses us or something, then we fall asleep because it's boring. Sometimes people who are praising us get our attention, and people who criticize us get our attention, but people who do neither are sometimes like, well, I'll go on to someone else. Kind of unfortunate kind of social phenomena. If you're not pushed around by the worldly winds, then praise and blame don't give you some extra kick that some people get addicted to. But someone praises you, it's okay, that's okay. Someone criticizes you, that's okay. The Buddha once said, they'll blame you, criticize you if you talk too much. They'll criticize you if you talk too little. And they'll criticize you if you talk just a moderate amount. No one in this world is free of criticism. So, of course, that's very helpful for a Dharma teacher. Wondering how long I should talk for. I can't win. So there was the worldly winds, comfort and discomfort, pain and pleasure. It's also something that certainly it's possible. It's fine to avoid pain, or it's fine to kind of enjoy your pleasure. But some people get pulled around by these things, get very reactive if they're feeling uncomfortable. Sometimes concluding something is terribly wrong with themselves, or their pursuit for comfort and pleasure is so powerful that people lose their not only their equanimity or their calm or tranquility, but sometimes people lose their lives. It's very intense, the people's tremendous addiction sometimes to pleasure or the avoidance of something that's uncomfortable. And to live a wise life, I believe, involves a capacity to be present for things that are uncomfortable, to be present for things which are very comfortable, very pleasurable, in a way that we're not pulled around by the nose by them. We're not kind of under their control, but rather we can experience them as they are and be equanimous, be balanced, be even-minded, be centered, or whatever you want to call it, and then, you know, see what needs to be done, see what's wise, whether it's appropriate or not appropriate or whatever.
Gil?
Yes.
It sounds to me that if someone is equanimous, they're not dead, but it sounds like they've let go of their ego, which is a very good thing.
Yes, so the question is, it sounds that as if when someone is equanimous, they're not dead, but they've let go of their ego. Their ego is dead, which sounds like a good thing. Now, I think that's a good point, because one of the primary triggers for agitation, for restlessness, for reactivity, has to do with our self-centeredness, has to do with our self-referential concerns, has to do with our sense of self, the way we want to represent ourselves to the world. And so we get caught very quickly by that. So someone who has managed to free themselves from being attached to self-image will find themselves naturally much more equanimous in the world because they don't have that particular trigger. And so, but you know, you said first thing, it sounds like they're dead. I mean, I thought you were going to go a different way. This is not a criticism of you, but many people kind of hear the teachings of equanimity and feel like, oh, that's kind of like, you know, not really someone who's really alive. Or the, you know, some of you know the T.S. Eliot line that says something like, teach me to learn how to be, to care and not to care. And right now I care a little bit about the air conditioner which is on. So I think that with all equanimity, I'm going to ask you, Pesha, if you could push the down arrow, or I guess up arrow.
Okay.
Maybe 80, yeah. So, because it's not good, it blows on me, and it's not good for it. I mean, I could do that and keep my equanimity, but but you know, it's okay to be equanimous and change things. All right. My balanced wisdom of sitting here, it feels like it's good to do something about this wind blowing on me. So teach me how to care and not to care, how to do both, I think. So how to care about what's going on, but not to care about how it affects our self-image, or whether people are going to praise us or criticize us, or whether people like us or not like us, or all the different ways that we sometimes care about the wrong things. We care about things which are going to cause us a lot of suffering, a lot of distress, a lot of agitation, a lot of contraction. So how to not care in a certain way, but at the same time to care, at the same time to be present and interested and available to offer what the world needs of us. So in that regard, the one form, there's many forms, Buddhism has actually many forms of equanimity. So it's kind of like they say that it takes a while to turn off, so just wait. They say that, I don't know if it's true, but you know that the Eskimos have a lot of different words for snow. So Buddhists have they don't have a lot of words for equanimity, but they have a lot of meanings for equanimity. There's different kinds of equanimity. There's one list of seven different kinds of equanimity. But one of the important forms of equanimity is a social emotion, social attitude that people have to each other that I consider to be a form of love. And it's one of the divine abodes that begins with loving kindness or goodwill. It's a form of goodwill. It's a form of goodwill or love we have when we can't, we care about someone, so that love is there, but you know, what we wish for them or how we want to help them doesn't help. People make choices for themselves that are maybe harmful. And we've helped them, we've supported them, advised them, whatever, and they still go out and do whatever stupid thing they're going to do. And so then what do you do? You kind of leave them alone. Sometimes you have to leave people alone to make their mistakes and learn from them. And for me, one of my Achilles heels has been my sense of responsibility for people. I'm responsible. It's up to me. And so I've had to learn not to take so much responsibility for other people. So the teaching of equanimity has been very important for me to realize that people make their own choices. And the choices they make have consequences. And they're responsible for that consequences, not me. And so I might wish it otherwise. I might still support them and help them. But I'm not responsible for the choices and the consequences. And I have to leave them alone with that particular part of it. And it's often called, sometimes called equivalent to grandmotherly love, or to be gender balanced, grandparently love, because it says that a grandparent loves the grandchildren, but because they're a grandparent, they've already raised kids. So they've seen it all in the kids. So they don't get anxious the way that first-time parents get anxious. For first-time parents, every scrape is like, oh my God, let's take him to the hospital. She scraped her knee. Grandparents, kids scrape their knees all the time. We'll care for them. We'll clean it and put a Band-Aid on it. But this is not something to, be so upset about or anxious about. And so some of that comes from experience, that we learn through experience how kids are and what they go through. And kids are kind of dramatic, some kids, And it's amazing how all of Shakespeare can be concentrated in 5 minutes in a, 5-year-old. And so, the kid says to the parent, I love you and I want to marry you. And then 5 minutes later, I hate you. So that's pretty dramatic, but if you're a grandparent, you've seen all that, and so you care and you do what you have to do. So I emphasize this because it's kind of, grandparents love their kids, supposedly, but they're not caught up in the drama of the situation in the same way. So to care and not to care at the same time. So how do we learn that? How do we learn to be equanimous in different situations? There's a number of different ways. Equanimity is very closely connected to wisdom, to having wise understanding about different situations. So in order to become equanimous, if that's needed, if you're reactive in a way that's not helpful for you, then it's helpful to explore and understand the situation better. And when it's a social issue, then there's a phrase given for equanimity practice, which is a very powerful phrase. And you don't have to believe this phrase, but for it to become a wisdom phrase, it's a phrase to grapple with, to explore, and to see how it might be true, rather than reacting to it firsthand. But, how is this? How does this work in this situation? And the phrase goes, beings are the owners of their actions. Beings are the beneficiaries of their actions. So beings are... the actual more technical way of translating to English would be, beings are the owners of their intentional actions. Beings are the beneficiary of the ears of their intentional action. So how is it that helps us to be equanimous? To realize that people own the consequence of their own actions. So it's what I said earlier. I could wish you otherwise, I could wish better for you, I can support you and help you, but I leave you alone in your choices you make. And the choices you make, you're going to have to live the consequences, and I can't live them for you. And that helps us to free us from the sense of responsibility, or not to get too entangled in ways which are not appropriate, and so keep us as equanimous. Now, one of the, to care and not to care, how the two things can go on at the same time, it's possible to have your heart broken. and remained equanimous. So being equanimous doesn't mean that you don't have a deep feeling for what's going on. It means that you don't contract, you don't tighten up, you don't resist, you don't get agitated, you don't get restless. And it's quite something to stay open, relaxed, present, non-reactive, at the same time as having your heart broken, to feel some deep sense of sorrow or sadness over something that's going on. But what equanimity helps you do is to stay present in a useful way, even if your heart is broken. It also helps you stay present when there's all kinds of things going on in life. There's a lot of emotions that can come through us, a lot of things that can happen. And equanimity is not a substitute or not a dampening down necessarily of the human tendency to have feelings and responses to all kinds of things. Generally people are calmer and less reactive, but there's something very beautiful about equanimity becomes a place for a cleaner channel for our emotional and mental life. I remember once being on retreat and I was doing walking meditation, the retreat, and I had my walking spot in this big hallway. And so I was happily doing my walking meditation back and forth, being equanimous and peaceful, minding my own business. And I saw someone coming down the hallway, doing slow walking meditation. I don't know where he was going, but I didn't pay much attention until he was standing in my walkway. And then he was doing his walking meditation in my walkway. And then I thought, oh no, this is going to be a game of chicken here or something. slowly kind of walking towards each other and see who's going to blink first. But the thing was that I felt all this anger surge up in me. But the anger didn't stick anywhere. The anger just moved through me and kind of dissipated. It felt like my mind had Teflon on it. It just kind of moved, because the mind was so equanimous and in non-reactive mode. I still had the reaction, but the reaction didn't have any effect on me. I didn't tighten up or resist or close down or decide to do anything. And it was quite beautiful to experience that clean channel to the anger coming, then just going, to not feel like the anger had to become anything. It didn't have to affect me anyway. It didn't have to push me around or make me act in any way or continue thinking anyway. There it went. So I think of equanimity as being a great support for actually a deeper, cleaner, fuller life than the lack of equanimity. There are times when we have all kinds of feelings, some of them maybe not so even so helpful to have, where equanimity is very helpful because we feel it more fully and see it more clearly. And sometimes the stronger feelings we have that maybe are difficult for us don't need us to fix them, don't need us to judge them. They just need us to be a clean channel for them so they can process themselves, they can move through us and free themselves rather than us to do it. And part of the difficulty we have is strong feelings, emotions sometimes, is not that we have them, but rather is the ways in which we resist them or attach to them or attach to something in relationship to them, or we are caught up in beliefs and ideas about them, and we get complicated our relationship. But the equanimity is one of the ways that allows us not to be bothered by things, not caring part, but also to be very respectful of it, of whatever's going on, to offer it our presence so that we can learn from it and let it kind of move through us. So one of the ways of developing equanimity is wisdom. So to explore, what's going on here, and one of the other wisdom statements or questions, approaches, is that internal equanimity, the social equanimity has to do with this question, that the statement that people are the owners of their own actions. The kind of more personal one for yourself is, why is it worth sacrificing your ease for this situation here? So say you're moderately easeful, at ease, calm, or settled in your life, and then something stirs you up. Something agitates you. Why are you? Why? What's so important about this situation? What's the trigger that that you wrap your mind around that forces you or kicks you into some agitated state? Why is it? Why is it important to worry right now? Why is it? What's so significant to what's happening right now that you get restless? What's so significant right now that you feel distressed about the situation? And so part of the wisdom kind of approach to this is to ask that question and explore it. Because chances are that when you get agitated or triggered in a deep way, that you haven't really understood some of what the actual trigger is. And to go back and question it is and explore it is one of the ways to come back and find a wise approach to equanimity. Another approach to equanimity or a thing that supports equanimity is to understand or to have available to you a inner practice, a contemplative practice, a mindfulness practice, a Buddhist practice, a practice that helps you meet life from a deeper resources, a fuller understanding, from freedom, from love, from caring, to have a practice that helps you along those lines. Because then you always have something to do. There are situations we find ourselves in where the external world, we don't even know what we're supposed to do. The whole thing is distressing, it's difficult, it's challenging. Maybe there's no hope. Maybe it's a hopeless situation. Sooner or later, chances are most of you will find yourself in at least one hopeless situation. And you can't really, you know, nothing's going to work, nothing's going to help. You're dying anyway. You know, you know, most of you will, and so in those kinds of situations where you can't do anything about the situation, you can still do something about yourself in the situation. You can turn around and have a practice that helps support you to find the place of balance, to find the place of peace, to find the place of wisdom, to find the place of love. To find, you know, have this inner practice that helps you find your way so that you don't become burdened or troubled or bothered by the situation you're in. I know people who've gone to into surgery and have reported back and said, you know, I've been to surgery a few times, but once I learned Buddhist practice, it was a whole different thing, because in the past I went into surgery and I was just a victim. There was nothing I could do. I just like was laid there in the jersey and just had to wait for these people to do something and hopefully wake up. And I was a kind of dependent on these people, the surgeons and people. But once I learned a practice of loving kindness or following my breath or anything, then suddenly I felt like I had something I could do that was helpful. And I had a way, and I didn't feel like I was just kind of a passive recipient of people doing things to me. And it felt empowering. So, you know, rather than feeling helpless, practice gives you something that you can do that can be helpful. So in a variety of ways, if you have a practice and you have confidence in that practice, that's a great support for equanimity, because then you know that you bring that with you. You know you have something you can do. You're not a victim. You're not lost. You're not, it's never a completely hopeless situation, because you can always, even if, you know, if it's hopeless out there in the world or externally, you always have something here you can do. The Buddha gave a very dramatic analogy that when something like this, if you're trapped inside this huge, I don't know if it was metal, but a huge, like this huge cliff wall that's moving in from the east. And moving in from the west is another big, massive wall. And moving in from the north is a big, massive wall, and from the south is a big, massive wall. It's coming in, coming in, coming in, coming in. It's going to crush you. That's pretty hopeless, right? I don't know where he thought about this 2,500 years ago. But the idea is, even then, the Dharma, even then, the practice can support you and help you. Now, it's hard in that kind of situation because, like, you know, people get so frightened. But that's one of the functions of Dharma practice, if you're a developed practitioner, is to learn to work with that fear, to have something to do with the fear. You can practice with it. So as soon as you have confidence in the ability to apply practice in a situation, then you're not going to be a victim to a situation. And then it's easier to stay balanced, stay calm or equanimous in the situation. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier. So that's confidence is a very important quality. And hopefully you don't have these big walls coming down at you, but you could have a flat tire on the freeway. You know, that's bad enough, right? And you realize that you no longer have your spare. So that's pretty hopeless. Yeah, you have to do something. But even there you can practice. Even there you have something you can do to help deal with that situation in a wiser way. Maybe realizing you actually can take care of the situation better if you're equanimous than if you're running around your car nervous on the middle lane in the freeway or whatever. Another thing that brings equanimity is a well-developed mind. So one of the functions, again, of Buddhist meditation practice is to develop the various strengths of the mind. So those strengths are there. So just like you go to the gym to have a well-developed body, and that well-developed body gives you a kind of stability, physical stability, in certain situations in life you go about. So when you come to the gym at the corner of Hopkins and Birch, the IMC gym, one of the things that's going on here, if you're doing this practice, if you're noticing when the mind drifts off and you come back to your breath over and over again, that develops and strengthens a variety of different factors of the mind. One of the things it develops is it develops a strength of your capacity to let go. Another thing it develops is your capacity to be concentrated. And as these two capacities become stronger and stronger, they lend themselves to a greater and greater sense of equanimity. With time, the concentration can get quite strong, and that strong capacity for equanimity carries over into daily life, carries over a certain calm, balance, equanimity, where it's much more difficult to be triggered by things around us. Someone can say something that normally you get agitated or upset by, and because of your strong concentration, strong, balanced state of mind, you can hear it, and it doesn't strike anything, doesn't impact anything. There's no hooks in your mind to kind of latch onto. You have this wonderful, beautiful Teflon mind. Maybe that's a terrible analogy, but... maybe a better analogy would be like a completely beautifully peaceful flat lake top, where it's so peaceful and calm that you can do two things. You can skip a stone really far, lots of skips. I've been doing a lot of skipping with my little kids lately, and so the flatter it is, the less ripples there are, the further you can skip it. Just kind of skips along the surface. So when the mind is equanimous, things kind of skip off, and rather than sink in to you. But also, when the mind is when the pond is really flat and still and tranquil, then you can look over into the pond and see your reflection. And so the same thing when the mind is equanimous, that you can see yourself so much better. When you're equanimous, you're much less likely to be a biased observer of yourself, because human beings have a tremendous capacity for self-deception. And part of the forces of self-deception are desire, aversion, confusion, delusion, fear, many things that kind of come into play. Ego is a big thing, or self-image, self-idea. And so when the mind is equanimous, you have a much better chance to see how these reaction forces work, or they're not going to work at all. And so you see yourself much better. Maybe you see yourself in some depth, like you look in the bottom of the lake when the lake is flat and clear. So when you have equanimity, you can see yourself very deeply. So I think that equanimity is not at all a state of indifference or a flat state or a boring state, But it's a very deeply satisfying state because as the stronger the equanimity is, the greater the depth of connection we have to ourselves, the greater fullness, depth is a good word, I feel, more profound or full, or the feeling or sense of what's here, our sense of presence is. And it allows us to do this very, I think, very important thing that I hope we all learn, is how to care and not to care. How not to care and care at the same time. Not one or the other. So those are my thoughts this evening on equanimity. And since it's in part a wisdom practice, you might consider this week to do some reflections on your own on this topic of equanimity. And especially if many of you don't use the word maybe much in your vocabulary, is to kind of consider what this word might mean for you and how it might play out and experiences in your life when you've had equanimity. And also I'd recommend that you find someone this week, some friend or some other person, and have a conversation, you know, someone somewhere, someone at the bar, I don't know. That's probably the wrong thing to have said. You know, it could be a stranger in a park or, you know, anywhere. Ask them if you could have a conversation with them about equanimity, and explore the topic with them. And because the more you kind of reflect this on this wisdom topic, the more you'll become wise about it. That's what I recommend. So, thank you.